the 30th of September 1793, it was a Monday evening. At 8:15, a troop of Herefordshire militia, who were based up at the Old Council House, which is where Small Street, Corn Street and Broad Street meet, walked down from up there to Bristol Bridge, 8:15 in the evening. The streets around here were crowded with people, and the crowds had been building up over the evening. It was a warm evening. The militia walked down from the council house, preceded by a couple of guys playing drums and a fife. They took their position in the middle of the bridge over there. There was a hush from the crowd. There was a rumour that the soldiers would not fire, or if they did, they would fire blanks. The soldiers took their position in the bridge, just over there, 100 yards away, and fired directly into the crowd. They fired southwards, where we now have Victoria Street, and then they turned round and fired northwards up Bridge Street. And the crowd dispersed. There were 11 bodies lying on the ground and 45 injured. So, you know, what happened to bring about this event? If we're to judge a kind of riot by the number of people killed, this was one of the worst riots of the 18th century, and very few people know about it. Okay, so let's just, and hopefully you'll be able to see this, but this is a list of the people who were killed on that night. Produced a few days later, there are 11 people there, and it's a very useful kind of list because it tells you the sort of people who were killed. And these weren't troublemakers, they weren't revolutionaries, they weren't even youths. It was a general crowd of people. John Abbott, aged 55, Elizabeth Keegan, somebody just passing through Bristol. These weren't troublemakers, they weren't revolutionaries, this was just a cross-section of the population who had unfortunately got caught up in the fire. There's 11 people listed here, three died later in the infirmary. So in all we're talking about 14 people killed. And this is a list of the wounded. And it tells you how they were wounded in the thigh, where they were shot. There's a couple of sabre wounds as well. There's stories of soldiers chasing after people as well. So that is what happened on Bristol Bridge on the 30th of September 1793. So how did this all come about? Now we've got a pretty intelligent, well-informed audience here. So I'm going to give you a little quiz. It's multiple choice. There's no shame. But I just want to kind of establish it in the background. You've got N, right on it. Can confer with your neighbour. Okay. So just have a couple of moments looking at that. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, right. So this is about Bristol in the 1790s, just to give you a bit of context. The population was
100,000.
It was in fact 70,000. And Bristolians, they'd always said, oh, it's 100,000. And Bristolians, there'd been this myth in the 18th century that it's the second city of the kingdom. But in fact, if anybody travelled around the country, you went to Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, these were cities on the growing. Bristol was no longer the second city of the kingdom.
My question, I've always puzzled about that. What do we mean when we say the second city? Because we call ourselves the most, one of the financial highest.
Yeah, yeah.
That is not the measure of the city. So what do they mean in those terms?
I think it was just a badge of pride, and I don't think there was any kind of way you could just define that, but they would say, after London, we're the most important. And it's just a way that they thought, and they weren't. Okay? 17, involvement in the slave trade was on the decline. The 18th century is largely Bristol's golden age of the transatlantic trade, if you can have such a thing. But that trade was winding down. And generally Bristol's trade, as a large port, was also winding down. Tidal range of the docks could be 45 feet. That's a hell of a lot. The river was going up and down twice a day, and at full tide, 45-foot drop. The docks were showing their limitations, whilst up to the north of England, you've got good docking facilities in Liverpool and other ports. And something had to be done about the poor state of Bristol's docks. Many days of the year you couldn't even bring a boat up here. Okay. Bristol Bridge, which I can see from over here. Where did the stone come from? Mm-hmm. Surprisingly enough, it came from over in Monmouth. it's a relevant fact, because what Bristol was doing was trading with Wales. We're on Welsh back. This is where the Welsh boats came from, and they were actually there's some big stones which were brought by boats down the River Wye, across the Severn and up here, and used for building. And somebody said that Bath stone is more a kind of ornamental stone rather than a kind of structural stone. Okay, Kingswood Miners.
Honest labourers.
This is the reputation. Bristol always felt, they always had the mind that the untamed, wild Kingswood miners could sweep in here at any notice that if there were food shortages. They always had this feeling that something was going on out there and they needed to watch out. And I think it was Charles Wesley when he said he was going to North America to speak to the Native Americans to convert them to Christianity. And he said, well, you better go out to Kingswood first of all. So there's all this presence of kind of malign anger out at Kingswood. It's still there, actually. Thomas Paine writes a man. Yeah, it was a massive bestseller. And one can't kind of... we think of today of bestsellers, but this was a book that was read bought and purchased. And if you read the newspapers of 1793 in Bristol, Thomas Paine, every week there's a mention of him. He was like the kind of political David Beckham. There was always an item about Thomas Paine or break up with his wife or whatever. He was the kind of bogeyman figure. People had this in the mind. And it's a fantastic book if you know the clarity of the writing. Anybody who hasn't read it, I would recommend it. Numbers of newspapers published. Six, no, five. five newspapers. And people were well informed. And you read the Felix Farley's Bristol Journal, and it's not only local news, it's news from London, it's news from abroad. And I think we tend to forget how well informed people were. There's a daily coach to London. Bristol wasn't kind of cut off from the world. People knew what was going on. There were boats coming in from the West Indies that they were reported what they were carrying. So there is an age of information even then. Bristol Corporation. what else is new? they were extravagant and remote, and we will talk about the structure of the council, but they weren't a well-respected bunch of people. They were self-electing. For generations you would have certain families as councillors and aldermen. Now it was an elite and an oligarchy. And finally, the administrative year in Bristol started at Michaelmas, which is the 29th in this year, the 29th of September. And as we will see, that's a crucial point about the riots, in that we have a new mayor instated when these events are happening. Okay. So this is just a kind of overview of what's happening in Bristol. Trade is on the way. There is revolution abroad.
Read a little bit.
In their newspapers, earlier on in the year, Bristolians opened their Felix Farley's Journal to read a heading, Murder of Louis the 16th, Paris, Monday, January the 21st, 12 noon. The unfortunate Louis is no more. He was beheaded at 10 o'clock in Place Louis XV. There is revolution happening abroad, and people are very aware of what is going on in France. A couple of months later, war was declared with France. There is a lot of paranoia, and French people living in Bristol were being watched with suspicion. So there's this paranoia. There is revolution in the air. Okay, so that's just an overview of what was going on. I hope you can see these slides. But just to go back to the bridge. The bridge in Bristol's history is very important. In fact, without a bridge, we wouldn't have Bristol. This was the second version of the bridge built in 1247. And what is it? It's a shopping mall. That is Cribbs Causeway. And it was a very important trading place. And the road went through it, was very narrow, only about 14 feet wide. Carts couldn't pass each other, it was constantly congested, as Bristol Bridge always seems to be. By the middle of the 18th century, it was obvious that this bridge would no longer suffice, and London Bridge had been rebuilt. Everybody was rebuilding their old bridges, and it was time for Bristol to do likewise. You can see with this map, this is the Millard's map, and there's a kind of aerial view at the top. And you can see how narrow it is, and there's a little chapel going across it as well. I don't know if you know this map, but there's a lovely little vignette of a man, this is totally irrelevant, but I just like it, of a man with a horse in his boat. And I was wondering, how do you get a horse in a rowing boat like that? But that's where one of the ferries what was. Okay. So the new bridge, they need a new bridge. They had an Act of Parliament to rebuild it in 1756. Took about 10 years to build. And of course, how do you fund a bridge like this? There was a house rate, there was import duty, and a toll which was to last for 25 years. And the toll was on a kind of sliding scale. If you were taking a flock of sheep over, it would be sixpence. If it was a horse and cart, it might be threepence and such like. But the important point is that foot passengers went across for free. The common person walking across the bridge did not have to pay. We just need to bear that in mind. And here's the new bridge 10 years later, very much echoing the design of Westminster Bridge, built with a Monmouth stone. You can see the little toll, the pepper box toll houses at the end where the toll keeper lived. And it had the balustrades were about 7 foot high. This was to stop cattle and sheep and animals from jumping over into the river, which they sometimes tended to want to do. So people they grinned and bared the toll. It had to be paid for. Come 25 years later, the toll was due to finish. The money had been gathered, and all debts paid off. There was a general suspicion of that the people who administered the toll fund, and their accounts, they refused to publish them. When they did, they didn't seem to make sense. But generally, it was expected in September 1793 that this toll would come to an end. And the guy who looked after the toll, he was getting under a lot of pressure because people were saying, "Oh right, this will be the last time I'll be paying the toll." And on Thursday the 19th, he had an argument with somebody who said, "Look, I'm not paying anymore. The toll's due to finish. I'm not paying." And a crowd gathered round, and eventually the toll keeper said, "Okay, right. Let's just leave it at that then." And it was suspended. And in the time on the tradition, what you do with toll gates is you take them off the hinges and have a big bonfire. On the middle of the bridge, the toll gates were burnt. Barrels of beer appeared from nowhere. A general party. You know, this is liberty for the Englishman. No more toll. This was Thursday evening. Then, to everybody's surprise, the lease for the toll was auctioned on Saturday. for another year of taking the toll. You know, what's going on? The toll is paid off. But the toll commissioners, the bridge commissioners, suddenly decided that they needed another year of income.
How much was the year of income?
I really don't know, because they never published the accounts. But this was reckoned to be a knockdown rate. This was cheaper than a previous auction. So that's a substantial amount of money. Okay? For the next week, people are going across the bridge for free. Until Saturday. Now, this was not a good day to put up new toll gates. Saturday, especially Saturday evening, everybody's got their wages in their pockets. You know, there's lots of celebrations in the streets, as there always is in Bristol on Saturday night. And these toll gates were attracting a lot of attention. Protests were starting, and by the evening, we have another bonfire. New toll gates gone.
This is 10 days on?
This is 10 days, not quite 10 days. And that's an important point.
This is the evening of the ninth day.
This is, whatever the maths is, but it isn't quite 10 days. Because the rumour was that if they didn't collect for 10 days, then they were not allowed to, that the whole deal was invalid. So, but why do you ask?
I can't see the time.
Right, okay. So, well, that's the date. So I think that's almost coming up for 10 days. I think that's the ninth day. Okay? So the gates were burnt. The parish constables, and we'll briefly look at the kind of policing, were called out, and they were reluctant to come out, and very few did. And in lieu of this, the Hereford militia, who were stationed out at Stapleton looking after French prisoners, were summoned into town. Now, officially, to have use of the militia, you needed to speak to the Home Secretary. This didn't happen. It was obviously a local arrangement, and they were brought in. By the end of the evening, the militia fire above the heads of the crowd. And this is an illegal act. They shouldn't be doing this. And one poor, unfortunate guy was hit by a ball ricocheting and later died. Okay, so that's our first demonstration on that Saturday night. Just to take you about the official government of Bristol. The mayor on these days, on this Saturday night, was Henry Ben Gough. The next day, he was due to hand over office to James Morgan. So this is the Michaelmas handover. Ben Gough was a well-established local leader, and you know, he knew the rules of the game. James Morgan was a druggist from Corn Street. All accounts, a very nice guy, but a bit of a pushover, and this was his first day in office. He's got a riot on his hands. So you've got the mayor. The mayor was appointed by the previous mayor, and you have 12 aldermen who also appoint each other. And if you're an alderman, you're an alderman for life. There are two main players in this whole affair, who had both previously been mayors, and they still acted like they were mayors. Poor old James Morgan just didn't stand a chance against George Daubeny, who was this kind of strutting egomaniac who kept on kind of giving orders when it wasn't his role to do that. And another figure, John Noble, the same sort of character. Okay, mayor usually chose his own successor. Mayor would ultimately... Now, this is another point, that when the militia came into Bristol, they were ultimately under the control of the mayor. That was the person who was to be giving the orders. Okay. And just quickly, policing of the city, there was no police force as such. There were parish constables who... It's difficult to kind of judge what their role was, but they were called out on occasions to kind of enforce the law, but they didn't really have much authority. And there were night watchmen, Charlies, who they were around just kind of keeping an eye out at night time. So the policing of the city was pretty lax, and the militia, in the last resort, could be called in. So, Sunday morning, Michaelmas. In the morning, the new mayor is installed, James Morgan, over in the mayor's chapel on College Green. At noontime, the toll is reintroduced, and they haven't got any gates, so they put a chain across. There's big protests. It's Sunday, people aren't working, bit of time on your hands, get down to the bridge. And the Riot Act was read. The Riot Act states that if you don't disperse within an hour, you can't. The militia are not responsible for your safety. So you've got an hour to wreak havoc, and then you need to get out. And it was read, and nothing happened. The militia arrive, and they stand there, and in the middle of the bridge, like standing like toy soldiers, didn't do anything, nobody enforced the Riot Act, so, people say, oh, they're not going to do anything. And by evening, free passage is allowed. So things, it could go either way at this stage. Monday morning, chain pulls across the roadway. Riot Act read three times. Crowds building up. The whole of the city centre was brought to a halt. Now this is the main traffic artery between North and South Bristol, and there was chaos. The militia arrive, protests continue, militia withdraw to the council house at dusk. And then something strange happened, that the crowd kind of took a momentum of its own, that people at the end of the working day headed down to Bristol Bridge, as if something was going to happen. And there were crowds of people, families, children on shoulders, people on rooftops, everybody looking out the windows to see what was going on. There was a feeling that, this was going to be the showdown. But at dusk, the militia withdraw to the council house. Oops. And free passage allowed. At that moment, they haven't got any toll gates to burn, so they break into those little pepper pot huts and grab some furniture and chairs. Build a big bonfire on the bridge, and this general kind of partying, singing of God Save the King, everybody's having a good time. Early in the evening, a squad of eight soldiers, the militia had moved up to the council house, a small squad of eight soldiers march down to the bridge and just stand there. And they're pelted with brickbats, oyster shells, stones. Just where we're standing was a fish stall selling oysters, and there were piles of shells, Drake missiles. And this poor Captain Maxwell and his eight men stood there, and then about 10 minutes later marched away again.
They're the militia.
They're just a group of eight militia. Why they're doing this was never explained, but I think they're just kind of testing the water. They go back, and then a few minutes later, the whole troop of militia walk down to the bridge and fire north and south on the crowd without any warning. So the riot act had been read in the afternoon, but this was unexpected.
Are they in the middle of the bridge firing out?
Yes. So they stand in the middle of the bridge, they fire up the road towards Victoria Street, which wasn't there then, it was Bath Street, and then they turn round and fire up that way as well.
So the crowds are in the
side of the bridge? The crowds are all round there, on the bridge, they're hanging out the windows round here, but they're firing directly at those people in the street. I think probably could do. Yeah. You know, if they're in the middle of the bridge, it's not a big distance. And the rumour had been, because the night before they had fired into the air, that they would fire in blanks or fire above the crowd. But this time they fired directly and indiscriminately into the crowd. Okay. So that's Monday. The next morning, now this is James Morgan's second day in office, they realise what a mistake they had made. When they look at the bodies and the dead, these are not troublemakers, they are not revolutionaries, they are not supporters of Tom Paine. And the big question is, who was responsible for the militia opening fire? It should have been the Lord Mayor, but he hadn't even said anything. So they kind of closed ranks. There were various people saying, right, we must have an inquiry about this. But anybody who did that and approached the council were branded as troublemakers and revolutionaries. We were at war with France. There are agent provocateurs around, and we will not have an inquiry. And if you look at the council records, there is a council meeting, and there is absolutely no reference to this event at all. No, they're just discussing the price of the turbot, according to the council records. there is no information. What was going on, meanwhile, was there were inquests on the bodies. And I think we'll see, this going back to this sheet, the verdict of the coroner was willful murder by person or persons unknown. And that's a kind of heavy indictment. And really, it's hinting at who is in charge of the militia. And even further down, there is a bit where it says, the verdict returned by the jury sworn to inquire the cause of this gentleman's death was willful murder by the person who ordered the military to fire. The coroner refused to receive this and induced a return to the second verdict. So, you know, murder by person or persons unknown. Now, this was a heavy criticism. But that's as far as it went. Let me just underline this. So who was responsible? The mayor? The commander of the militia? They didn't want an inquiry to find out. I'll just read, this is a letter which was sent to William Pitt by a Bristolian. Sent anonymously to William Pitt, the Prime Minister, on the 3rd of October. It was difficult to read, but you get the sense of this. And he wrote, "My dear sir, help us to have justice. Our streets are filled with the murdered bodies of the inhabitants. The most wanton cruelty has been exercised by Lord Bateman's soldiers." He was the commander of the militia. We should have no disturbance. Was it not for the corporation? Help us, kind, generous sir. We shall all be murdered. For God's sake, send us some help or some person that is human. George Daubeny has brought this misery on a people peaceably inclined and firmly attached to His Majesty and the present constitution by a show of justice. I wrote to the King, and long may he live. Do pray and send some person. They are now at the Guildhall, going to fire again. We shall be murdered, indeed so we shall be. They have so enraged the people. Oh, what misery in bad hands. This is a guy, he's totally freaked out. Now the corporation have gone to dirt. They're shooting everybody. You know, here he is. This isn't, no, these aren't revolutionaries. And people in Bristol were just saying, what is going to happen next? Okay, the council issued two handbills, and this was one, an appeal for calm, and there was another one which said, yeah, okay, been a bit of a problem, but things will calm down. And that was it. And if you were to be a historian researching from council records, you'd find very little information about the Bristol Bridge riots. And that's why very little has been written about it. I'm just going to take a little tack about when I was writing this book, the resources that I used. So there's very little from the council. The great thing is, what happens next, there is a whole flurry of privately produced pamphlets. And they come in various categories. There's the kind of well-reasoned leaflet, and there were two of those, one opposing the corporation and one pro-corporation. And then there was a fantastic amount of satirical handbills, which we will have a look at. And then this was the time of the Romantic poets, and a couple of years later Wordsworth and Coleridge were to meet up in Great George Street, and people had a little bit of a go at writing some poems about this. The pamphlets, which are, they both very much agree on the chain of events. It's the perspective that's different. I think, now whenever you have a pamphlet with the word impartial, somebody's got a point of view to put over anyway. The phrasing that the late riots is the one which was pro-corporation, and late disturbances is anti-corporation. Okay. Now, I don't know if you can see this. So this is one of these fantastic scurrilous broadsheets that came out. And this is a kind of typical broadsheet at the time. It's Cain and Abel Tavern, and they're celebrating all the good work. The surgeons have got lots of work. The undertakers have got lots of work. They're generally thanking the council for giving them business. The grave diggers, you know, they're rolling in money now, and the relatives, I can't remember what they're doing, but they're all partying, and thanks corporation for doing this. They are very humorous, and there's a lot of kind of detail. Once you know who they're talking about, it's a good, there's lots of good meaty stuff here. And this is another one. And this is a time-honoured one. Have you done an auction of public worthies? This is a good one, where you put up the public worthies for auction see kind of what they get. And there's lots of kind of detail here. And I'll just see what's the best. Excuse me, Mr. Auctioneer, my sight is rather bad. Pray, is the lot male or female? It is a hermaphrodite, madam. And this is the publisher of the local newspaper they're putting up today. So there's a lot of information here. And you could, when I was looking at this, I thought, oh, that's who's doing what. So when I first came across these sheets, I thought, you know, what use are they? But in fact, I'm sure there's more truths in these than any official report. Okay. And then there's another one here, and this hints that it's insinuated that the citizens wanted a revolution and a mob government. And this is saying, this is what the council is saying. You know, and they're saying, God save the king and our liberties. But the council is saying all these people are revolutionaries. Meanwhile, in the drawing rooms of Great George Street, they were composing genteel verse. And this is sort of thoughts occasioned by the proceedings, thoughts of a lady. And while bullets flew from street to street, leaving no moment to retreat, but winging through the smoke and fire, many numbers groan, bleed, and expire. And even more graphic, I'll leave you to read it yourself. The red blood, the streets with crimson stains, and Bosley's house was smeared with brains. Great, great Bosley. There was a Quaker person called Edward Long Fox, and the Long Foxes were a well-established Bristol Quaker family. And he thought, right, we really have got to do something about this. And he proposed to the mayor that they do have an inquiry. This was a couple of weeks later. And he even booked rooms at the Theatre Royal. Suddenly that booking was cancelled. He booked over in Lewinsmead. And he was kind of thwarted. And the corporation was still sticking to their guns that anybody who wants an inquiry is a troublemaker. So he very bravely set up his own unofficial committee of inquiry. He had a group of people, and it was well structured. They defined their aims, and they went out and interviewed people, and over about a period of several months, every evening they would go out and try and talk to people who were involved. A lot of people would speak to them, but some did. And in the central library is this record. He was aware that he could be in big trouble doing this. He took legal advice about the terms of reference. And after about 3 months, he spoke to a solicitor who said, you've got to be really sure of your facts if you're going to take on the corporation. And the interesting thing is this minute book, it's well written, it's minuted, and then it just stops. They don't even kind of come to a conclusion. They obviously realised that they were going nowhere. So the last entry was on the 3rd of March, 1794. And the corporation's approach of just sitting it out seemed to work. There was never an inquiry. They got away with it. The toll was never reinstated. A group of businessmen who were so fed up with this kind of constant melee in central town bought the lease and abolished the toll. James Morgan died 10 months later after he finished his office. George Daubeny carried on strutting around for another 13 years. And we do enter a period where there is a kind of national step back in the democratic process with the French Revolution and French Wars. And public meetings were outlawed and such like on a national scale. Of course, the riots of 1831 kind of hastened the reform of our government here. Now the interesting thing is that I was reading a history book written in the 1880s, and despite, you know, trying to black out this, there was this wonderful cry that local youths used to use to taunt authority, and they shout, "Give them Bristol Bridge!" on a Saturday night. So I think it ought to be kind of reintroduced. So that's it. Questions, comments, points?
Word on the your test.
Yes, the test.
I just said there were five newspapers.
Yes.
Was not this written about any of the press?
No, it seems like there was a kind of press release, because it was all the same thing, you know, and there were little columns, and that was about it. Now, surprisingly little. So there would be a few inches amount of disturbance, and that was it. And then the handbill from the corporation, that was printed. But there was no investigative journalism.
Sorry,
do you know who owned the newspapers at the time? Well, one of the guys, the hermaphrodite, Robert Rosser, was one of the newspaper journalists. But they just didn't kind of go in for that sort of reporting. Yeah.
If the poll has been lasting 25 years, there must be some estimate of what sort of money it's been.
Yeah.
Did I think I might have let my attention might wander a little bit? Did you say who bought the poll? Was it any of these prime movies?
No, it was a consortium of businessmen.
And George Dobney.
He wasn't one of them, and they were very scathing of that approach. They said, you know, you're giving in to the masses here. So it wasn't approved of officially by the corporation.
The shooting one wasn't.
No, what I'm saying is that the consortium buying the lease wasn't approved of, because and then letting people cross for free wasn't approved of. I think it was a kind of unofficial arrangement. But with regards to the accounts, that they were published, there's a big broadsheet, and it was generally felt that they had recouped the money, but then there was a kind of last minute plea that we need a bit more money to maintain lighting and other things. So the feeling was the money had been collected.
So the lighting would last forever, so the toll would last forever.
Maybe.
You mentioned the college, the Kingswood College. Were they involved in this trial?
There's no evidence. And just from that list of people who were killed, they were mainly local people, very local to these parishes, apart from some poor guy from Castle Carey who was passing by. So, you know, I just kind of looked at that, and they were all locals.
Yes. The colliers came in, took the drain off the ship, sometimes took a few hostages back to the mine with them, just in case they were advising to come to the bar. And it just seemed to be part of the political discourse of the age and tolerated. Was it, you think, the French Revolution and the pain that made this response significantly different from the corporation?
Yeah.
The sort of tolerant level of low level rising.
I think they, you know, they were genuinely worried, and there was correspondence with the mayor about kind of watching who was coming in. So there was this paranoia. You could read the newspapers about Thomas Paine, about the execution, and you know, I think up in the council house they were standing there thinking, oh my god, you know, the guillotine's going to be pulled out any moment now. Down here, people were singing "God Save the King, we're defending the liberty of Englishmen." You know, it was a totally different perception, and I think afterwards they realised that.
Thank you.
But anyway, he has no doubt. So that whole thing about God save the king, but wasn't there a whole change occurring at that stage in the crowd? Who, you know, there was the sort of, you know, especially the king, Bob, is that right? The loyalist crowd. But that loyalist crowd could also get out of hand
and end up
doing things which they might have this perception, you know, the perception is they were loyalists, but often if something kicked off, they'd end up like attacking the rich or.
It is difficult. You never know which way it's right. It's going to go, you know. And they could have rode it out, or hindsight. It's very difficult to say. But one last. This is the poll tax riots of nineteen nineties, and I just appeared in the Independent magazine. And the heading was, a West End shopper argues with a protester who is being taken away by the police. The next week, the West End shopper wrote into the newspaper, in fact, I wasn't arguing with a young man, I was arguing with the police, trying to tell him that this guy had done no wrong. You know, and there was this perception. And the picture editor got this and said, oh yeah, you know, she's shouting at the protester, but in fact it was the other way around. Different perception.
So what happened after?
Did the toll get reinstated? No. So when this consortium bought out the toll, they bought it so that it would no longer be levied.
Just one thing, on Monday night we did a session on the Radical 1790, and Steve Paul spent a long time explaining to us that the evidence about, you know, sort of Jacobin plots or revolutionary activity in the crowd was very, very thin in Bristol, because the council, as he mentioned actually this incident, the council didn't actually seem to like communicate with central government, and Bristol was very insular and kept
itself.
I'd just like to explain maybe like, If the council was so silent about this event, in terms of official record, I cannot believe, although you'd like to comment on this, that they were discussing this a huge amount about what they'd done and the fact that they were so paranoid. There must have been lots of discussions which created that paranoia in the first place. None of this was recorded, though.
No, they must have been incredibly paranoid. They didn't want any discussion, because the person who was ultimately responsible for this event was the person who gave the order to fire. And you'd think that would be very straightforward, but nobody quite knew who gave the order to fire. They all forgot, and it turns out the person who gave the order to fire was the mayor's secretary. But I reckon that before the soldiers, when they walked down to the bridge, they must have had a discussion up in the council house and said, right, okay, we're going to go down there and we're going to shoot. And in fact, you know, they decided up in the council house to shoot then, and the mayor's secretary, James Waller, was just kind of, you know, okay guys, go ahead and do it.
The very fact that the soldiers came down supposedly without votes in their government two or three times, that is so curious. It would seem to be inviting some sort of retaliatory justification.
And they were standing there for several afternoons, you know, being abused, stuff shouted, thrown at them, and because they didn't respond earlier on, people were getting more and more bold, and then when they did, you know, the people were surprised.
It's very, I mean, it's amazing. It goes in very so many parallels. The militia, you know, not doing much in the first place. Involved in the encouraged to ground, so not going to do anything. And the cop-ups and communication from the mayor who's responsible, what's going to control the militia. This is going on a rerun.
And the difference is that afterwards the inquiries were in depth. You know, there were court martials, there were insurance claims. Here, it's just nothing.
The number of soldiers, is it only the 8? The militia?
I'm not too sure. No, it was a small group of militia.
Fired at least 50 shots.
Yeah, the hundreds is reckoned.
Well, how gunless they were, letting off their guns
and shooting people. Yeah, you know, I don't know, but that, you know, that they didn't fire high, they aimed low.
Yeah, but you're saying, was it 8 people shooting 10 times, or was it 100 people shooting once?
I think it was a larger number shooting probably twice, because they've got to reload their muskets. So, but there is one story of somebody was shot, and the guy reloaded his musket and made sure he was finished off. Yeah. Well, on several occasions, but. On the day when this actually happened, it was raised in the morning several times. So it hadn't been raised for, you know, several hours. So normally you'd expect the riot act to be raised and then something happened within the hour.
Come back on my thing about 10 days.
Yeah.
This all happened, the actual shooting and killing didn't it happen?
Do you
know on what day of the 10 days
is
before the toll had to lapse anyway?
Yeah, well, you can work it out. So the toll lapsed the first time when the tollkeeper decided it would lapse was on the Thursday, and then this happened the following. Then there was a week intervening, and then. It all started again that weekend.
So that wasn't quite
10 days. Yeah. So I think it's on the 9th day that they re-erected and started collecting the toll.
Question one.
Sorry.
In this day and age, what sort of effect would having the riot act have? I mean, would anyone have taken any notice of it, or was it just sort of a run-of-the-mill thing?
I don't know, and maybe somebody can advise me on this, but the kind of story is that it means really you've got kind of half an hour to really get stuck in and then disappear. but you know, I really don't know. But if you keep on reading it, you know, the power goes eventually, doesn't it?
Was it something that people heard? Was it something people heard regularly anyway?
I think it was quite a powerful thing, but you've got to follow it up. You know. Right.
In all these things, the mob, the people are always, in the end, they're hacked to pieces and shot, and they're always portrayed as like total victims and you know, things where they're saying.
Yeah. No, you know, when they saw what was happening, when they really realised what was happening, people fled. And there's just one very poignant bit, and this is later on. So this was I'll just read this. When the street lamps broken, it was an impenetrably dark night. On his way home, Matthew Bennett tripped over a large object on the ground. It was the body of a young man, flat on his back, cold and quite dead. To his utter disbelief, Bennett realised that he was staring at a corpse, the corpse of his own son, James. This long, horrible moment was broken by Joseph Haller, the mayor's secretary, striding up to the bereaved father. Haller, who appeared to be in an exceptionally agitated mood, demanded, "Who is this fellow?" Bennett was so distraught that he could hardly speak. "It is my son," he cried. "Damn ye," said Paula. "Take him away directly, or I'll assure you worse would ensue. And this Joseph Paula is the guy who was reputed to have given the order to fire. Just a nasty, yeah. Okay. Thank you. This is all in a book called Riot, but unfortunately it's out of print. But it's available on eBay occasionally, so look out for it. But thank you very much.